Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. It is so wonderful to live in a state that's about three-fourths forested, to be swallowed up in all that lovely green once our mini spring and then summer arrive. And as we discussed yesterday, the gifts our maples give us in the form of that sweet sap that we can boil into syrup. And during this pandemic, it's been exciting to see so many Vermonters reconnecting with the lush forests that surround us and the silent, wonderful work these trees provide for us, for wildlife, for insects, and our waterways. They really should make us revere them even more. But they aren't absolutely perfect. There are challenges that need to be addressed. So we're going to take the next hour to get a better understanding of Vermont's trees and forests. Joining me this hour for the discussion is Michael Snyder, Commissioner of Vermont's Forests, Parks, and Recreation. He loves our trees as much as I do, but he knows tons more about them. And Michael, it's great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Rick. Wonderful to be with you.
And we also are joined by Tony D'Amato. He's director of UVM's forestry program. Tony, thanks for being on the show as well.
Thanks for being here, Rick.
All right. And listeners, if you'd like to ask a question or share a comment about our forest, please give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Commissioner Snyder, I'll start with you. I've always been fascinated by what I'll call Vermont's forest history, and I would have assumed that this was always a heavily forested land after recovering from the last ice age, but it has gone through some changes, especially after European settlers arrived. So kind of take us through some of that.
Sure. I'm happy to. And you've got it. And your opener here, Rick, was really spot on. And thank you for that. It's so fun to be here to talk trees and forests and Vermont's incredible forest strength, as I like to think of it. And indeed, forests, trees and forests are, you could say, since that last glaciation at least, the original native Vermonters. It is the native and natural expression of this landscape. And so you're right to wonder, and now we're so blessed with this expansive three-quarters of the state covered in forests, but it has not always been this way. Despite its early origins and where we are today, it did indeed go through a period of deforestation. Initially, relatively small openings in the forest attributable to native inhabitants who lived and made use of the forest. And then, as you suggest, with the onset of European colonization, there was first kind of an agrarian wave, subsistence farming, people cutting trees to scratch out a living from the landscape, and that it continued and increased into larger-scale agriculture with corresponding increases in clearing, and then with the development of urban areas, Boston, think of New York, the forests of New England, or the New England, Vermont included, were an important source of construction and fuel material for those as well. So this resulted in an extended period where kind of the inverse of what we have today, where the height of this land clearing, largely driven by agricultural use, maybe in the mid-1800s, we were about 20% forested by best accounts and 80% open land, and that's just about reversed today. So that's the basic pattern, and we can go from there.
And in the 1800s, the sheep industry was a very big deal in Vermont, so keeping it wide open spaces, unforested, 20% forest, was actually I don't want to use the word loosely, but advantageous for the sheep industry here in Vermont.
Right. There was dairy and sheep, and it was a prolonged period where that really was the dominant land use and was, again, mostly open, and it continued for some period until kind of a phase of farm abandonment for a number of reasons around the Civil War. Word of topsoil some 30 feet deep in Iowa, and without boulders and stones, and folks, and there was offers for folks to move west, and people did that. And so there was this gradual retreat. Hill farms in Vermont began to revert to forest, and that pattern continued throughout the early 1900s.
And Tony D'Amato, we're about three-quarters forested now, if I'm not mistaken. So how did we get from, you know, about 20% to about 75%? You know, that's a really amazing swing back to the forestation of Vermont.
No, it really is. And I think, you know, when we reflect on a lot of the challenges that face Vermont's forest today, and certainly things we'll talk about as it relates to insects and diseases and climate change, you know, one of the things that many of us often fall back on is the amazing resilience our forests have already shown following this tremendous transformation of the landscape that Mike described, both in the 19th century, you know, being almost denuded of most of the forest, and now we think of Vermont as a highly forested state. And so, as Mike mentioned, you know, describing the state of Vermont, you know, we are really fortunate to live in a place where trees want to be, you know, both from a climate standpoint, the soils we have here. And so if you leave a field open after you've cleared it, you know, give it 10, 15 years, and you'll start seeing a lot of trees in that field and ultimately a forest. And really what that speaks to both are the species of trees we have here that are well adapted to kind of recover from a disturbance, whether it's a windstorm or somebody plowing a field and removing trees from that area, as well as the climate we have here. You know, it's a wet part of the world, and so we have enough moisture that really favors trees. And so, as you mentioned, you know, we went from a period, you know, where in some cases we had 10 to 20% left of the forest that had been here prior to European settlement, and then now, you know, have sometimes 75, 85, 95% of that landscape dominated by trees. And so that really has become a key feature of what we have out here in Vermont. And really, trees can recover from anything except for, you know, a parking lot or you know, a large development. And so despite us being 75% forested, we've actually, in the last recent survey of forest conditions in Vermont, shown a decline in forest area for the first time in 100 years. And so that resilience and that tremendous recovery that we've all been celebrating, unfortunately, now is starting to trend in a slightly different direction. And so I think certainly is a reason people should be considering how are we growing the state and how is it impacting this tremendous natural fabric we have across our landscape.
And, Tony, that downward trend, is that because of development?
It is, yeah, primarily. And, you know, in the irony about you know, some of, you know, as you were describing with the clearing in the mid-1800s, you know, at that time there really was individuals like George Perkins Marsh and others that were – had seen similar levels of deforestation in other parts of the globe and the negative impacts that had on water quality and just quality of life. And so during that time period, as we were losing forests and seeing floods and all these negative impacts of that mass deforestation, really started to call to arms of, you know, to have forest conservation and certainly others that, like Weeks, that established helped establish things like the White Mountain and Green Mountain National Forest. You know, really, we're doing that in response to concern over losing forest land and kind of the impacts that had on the environment. And so today, you know, when we look at the impacts of development, really, land use and, you know, whether it's, you know, new home development or development in some cases of, you know, renewable energy and other you know, reasons for clearing forest land, for putting out structures, that's what we call a hard conversion of, you know, basically, trees are not going to reestablish without some major re-engineering of that area to allow them to grow again. So it's been a bit disconcerting for a lot of us to see.
Michael Snyder, what are the advantages of having a heavily forested state?
Oh, how much time do we have here?
You got the whole hour.
It's really something. You know, we really are so lucky. I do like to say we're forest strong. And what I mean by that is that there are enormous public benefits, and many of them unpriced, that accrue to all of us, including from the massive extent of private forest land. Most of this 75% of the landscape is forested. 80-some percent of that is private family forest owners. And we're so lucky because there are priced benefits. So it begins with this working landscape tradition That's about $1.4 billion every year in direct annual economic activity from forestry. Another $2 billion plus in related tourism and outdoor recreation, utterly dependent on that forested landscape. And then we quickly move into other benefits, less well monetized, but mm-hmm. clean air, clean water, flood resilience, atmospheric carbon mitigation, climate resilience, habitat, biodiversity, connectivity, our cultural values and traditions, and we could go on. These are all fundamentally important, and you could say, I think, a unique competitive advantage for Vermont. And this stunning landscape and our quality of life are attached to it, and I think it gives us a very strong incentive to acknowledge it, celebrate it, and really think about how to maintain it into the future, given globalization, climate change, increasing development pressures. We need human habitat, too. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to figure out here, but it begins with a recognition of just how darn lucky we are to be so forest strong.
Michael Snyder, let's talk about the challenges of our forests. What are they facing right now?
Well, we have, there's kind of ecological threats, if you will. There are cultural threats, different categories, everything ranging from really pressing concerns of invasive species. These would be plants, pathogens, pests that didn't evolve here, don't belong here, and really disrupt ecological function and health and integrity of our forests. So these are existing issues that are really challenging with very few simple solutions. And again, they just threaten the ecology function and values of and health of our forests. We have, and related, there are lingering effects of air pollution. Acid rain, remember, was a thing, and that has bearing. So we are seeing that reflected in trends in dieback and mortality, decreased growth in some species. We have regeneration failures. That's where we, baby trees, the next generation of forests in some cases, and localized overgrowsing, impeding that next succession of forest growth. Mm. And really the big ones are conversion of, as I think Tony mentioned, conversion of forest to non-forest use. And then the next I would add is in a category is kind of a crisis in the marketplace and the collapse of the market demand for certain types of forest products that really are important in kind of holding it all together. So, and there are many reasons for each of these things, many of which can be directed back to kind of a globalization and of commerce and trade and a lot of things happening out of sort of a natural pace, and they all conspire to create challenges. And the big one that we haven't gotten to would be climate change.
Yeah.
And there's a growing sense of how climate change, that forests are part of the answer to climate change, and that is hugely important. But at the same time, forests are vulnerable to climate change, and we're already seeing disruptions in forest process, timing, health and integrity related. And so that's a big overview of a variety of the challenges and threats that face our forests.
Tony D'Amato, you've both mentioned forest fragmentation. So explain to people exactly what that is and why that's a big deal to you and to Michael and to everyone concerned about forests.
Yeah, so I think, as Mike's introduction really pointed out, and there's various values that forests provide. And as you mentioned, we could spend maybe several shows or several weeks laying those out. But, each of those is impacted by forest fragmentation. And so if we start with, the cultural values we have from forests, both from an aesthetic, seeing these unbroken landscapes of trees and seeing having the opportunity to hike and not have to worry about crossing through multiple property boundaries, or, going into an area and not worrying about kind of what the adjacent landowner might be doing as it in terms of impacts on water quality. And so when you start fragmenting, and those, many of you are familiar with that process, but basically taking a large area of forest, let's say a 500-acre area, and then all of a sudden dividing that up into kind of house lots or putting in maybe even could be a, ridgeline, wind development or solar array, or it could be, a large kind of thoroughfare, road, all of those things all of a sudden interrupt that forest and kind of fragment it into smaller pieces. And so those smaller pieces, from a cultural standpoint, certainly have different values. But then ecologically, you know, there might be an organism, let's just say like a Canada lynx, that needs, you know, miles upon miles of large contiguous forest. All of a sudden, you break the forest up into smaller chunks, and, you know, that area is no longer a suitable habitat for that species. And there's a reason why that's a species we only encounter in the Northeast Kingdom, where we still have those large blocks of forest land without any interruption. And so, you know, that fragmentation really can have an impact on, you know, kind of the wildlife value. But then the final thing, as Mike mentioned, even from an invasive species standpoint, you know, often the areas of the state where we see the highest level of particularly the invasive plants are in those counties, like the one I live in, Chittenden County, where you have a lot of fragmentation of that landscape, you know, a lot of forest woodlots that butt up against either somebody's, you know, backyard or butt up against an agricultural field. And so those areas, those edge habitats, tend to be much more prone to invasion by, you know, things like buckthorn, you know, honeysuckle, other species that can be really challenging once they get into the forest. And so it really does influence that amazing unbroken green quilt that we view as being kind of a signature of Vermont. You throw one house in the middle of that or throw, you know, development, and it certainly can impact that. And so I don't want to belittle people need places to live,
right,
but we also know the impacts enough of that fragmentation to be smart about where we might do that development in the future to minimize those impacts.
Well, Tony, when I've heard about land trusts, I've always thought about farmlands that give Vermont that certain character that we love here. But I've had several people on the show recently that have talked about forest conservation. So is this a movement that's gaining momentum here in Vermont?
It is, and we're really spoiled, you know, as we always get into. We're super proud of everything that has the Vermont brand on it. But, you know, when it comes to land conservation and land trust, you know, I think we have really some of the best, you know, in the country, if not the best, particularly kind of the Vermont Land Trust and all they do. And as you pointed out, you know, part of, you know, the mission of these land trusts is to conserve kind of open land, and in the case of agricultural land, kind of working landscapes and preserving that culture. But likewise, Vermont Land Trust is also, and other land trusts, focused on both conserving kind of natural areas that might, for lack of a better term, kind of have a forever wild, you know, basically untouched, unique places. But at the same token, really protecting and conserving that working forest landscape, which is such a deep part of Vermont's history that's not really celebrated as much of it as agriculture. But really, if you think about the footprint of agriculture relative to forests in Vermont, has actually a larger kind of regional impact on how people have interfaced the land across the state. And so those land trusts are not just protecting land to conserve those ecological values, but they're also protecting land to conserve that key way of life that's connected to the Vermont identity, which is that working forest landscape. And so when we think about trying to stop this conversion from forest to development, the land trusts often are one of our most important agents of change in, you know, extinguishing through conservation easements the potential for development in those areas and really maintaining some of those other values like, you know, clean water, carbon, unfragmented landscapes that we really value.
Commissioner Snyder, we're talking about a lot of the problems and the challenges to our trees and our forests. So what is your department doing to combat these things?
A whole bunch, and I appreciate the offer to explain. It can begin with picking up where you and Tony just left off. We partner at Forest Parks and Recreation, at Fish and Wildlife, and the entire Agency of Natural Resources. We partner for a long time with these statewide organizations and local land trusts, Vermont Land Trust, Trust for Public Land, the Nature Conservancy, and again, many local land trusts, for a long time to help to partner with them in conserving lands, willing sellers, willing buyers, to conserve these lands. Some become public places, state forests, state parks, wildlife management areas. So that's an ongoing work. We also partner to hold easements, in some cases on private lands, particularly working forest easements through the Forest Legacy Program. And so that's in the sort of direct conserving of particular pieces of land, again, willing sellers, willing buyers. But then we move from there to we begin with our forest health program, just kind of tracking and monitoring the condition and status and health of Vermont's forests in rigorous ways, and systematically over time. as a baseline. And then we also do an awful lot of technical assistance from that in assisting landowners of all types and organizations and partners with assistance in the science of forest health, understanding it, how to react to it, responding to threats like emerald ash borer, et cetera, and other kind of protective approaches, planning. We have the county foresters in our private lands program giving technical assistance to private landowners throughout the state, 2 million acres in the current use program, some 16,000 acre parcels. And so that direct one-on-one engagement with our foresters, walking the woods with landowners, listening, helping them achieve their goals, learning what their options are, raising the bar of forest stewardship. So we have the state lands that we manage, and we have a staff that take care of. We add to that portfolio through conservation as well, the private lands outreach, forest health assessment and assistance. So a lot of education, outreach, guidance, support, and I'd like to think some good old-fashioned cheerleading, too.
We only have about 30 seconds before we have to get to the news, Commissioner. But, you know, I say about 75% of the state is forested. Is there a percentage that you'd shoot for where you'd feel very comfortable, you know, 80%, 85%? Or is it, you know, 76%, but just, you know, getting rid of some of that fragmentation?
Yeah, I think we're in a pretty good spot. We don't have like sort of a no net loss policy. As we've both mentioned here, we think it's important for human habitat too. It's really about mm-hmm. where and how. And we also know that there's real interest in farming and modernization there, and so we want to keep land available. So I think we're kind of, my sense is we're in the sweet spot in the mid 70s where we can hold it all together and have multiple benefits and multiple land uses.
We're talking trees, forests, and timber. We're going to take a break for CBS News, then be back to continue the discussion. And listeners, you can call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255 to jump in with your thoughts or your questions. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. As I awaited calls yesterday in our 10 o'clock hour, I had some time to share the poetry of Herbert Elliott, who was a farmer and poet from St. Johnsbury. And while we're on the subject of trees and forests today, I thought I'm going to read one more. It's called The New Leaves. And here we go. The last faint patch of roadside snow has vanished and gone underground. The maples standing in a row begin to have a leafy sound. And soon the trees will steal the glow of sunrise from my eastern panes, a million early morning thieves, the windy-sounding maple leaves. We've got Forest Parks and Recreation Commissioner Michael Snyder with us, along with Tony D'Amato. He is the director of UVM's Forestry Program. And listeners, you can join us. You can email VTViewpoint at RadioVermont.com, or you can call 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Tony D'Amato, I want to talk about the forestry program at UVM. What is the program responsible for?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. Obviously, it's something I take a lot of pride in and really and just feel honored to get to lead and participate with the other great faculty and staff at UVM. And really what we're responsible for are a few things as it relates to, you know, forests both in Vermont and really in the country and around the globe. And the part that I really take most pleasure in is that a main part of what we do is train future foresters and other forest conservationists with our undergraduate forestry program, which was accredited by the Society of American Foresters, and really gives the students kind of a full breadth of both the ecological knowledge they need to go out and understand what they see in the forest, but also, as we've talked a lot today already about kind of the human side of things and how do we balance these different stressors and pressures that we've been talking about and still conserve forest and, you know, produce the raw material that we use every day in our daily lives and and do that in a way that is leaving that forest better for future generations. And so a big part of what we do is work with our students, and the best part about teaching forestry is that much of what we do is outside with labs and really giving them hands-on opportunities in this tremendous natural laboratory that we have here in Vermont. And the second piece, you know, gets to some of what, you know, Mike's been referring to as well. You know, what's the science that we can develop, you know, scientists at UVM that will help, you know, Forest Parks and Recreation, other individuals really have the knowledge they need to, you know, conserve forests. How do we, you know, manage forests in the face of emerald ash or climate change, all of these stressors? You know, how do we develop effective policies that might be able to balance, you know, interest in, you know, climate change mitigation with still wanting to make sure that we can, you know, provide really successional habitat for bird species? And then finally, that last piece, and it speaks to, you know, as I mentioned, you know, communicating that information, and more importantly, partnering with, you know, foresters and other agencies in developing, you know, recommendations through outreach and extension and other techniques. And so we do a lot of service to the broader community in trying to work with forest managers, land trusts, other forest owners and forest users to find out both what their information needs are, but also to work with them to develop solutions for modern and future challenges that are facing Vermont's forests.
And Tony, as our world becomes more tech-driven and, you know, kids younger and younger are tapped into technology, are you still finding that there are students who are interested in this field of study?
Yeah, it's really been gratifying, you know, in that, you know, forestry as a major, you know, there was a time there where people were concerned about the number of students that were getting interested in going into that versus other fields. And we've seen tremendous growth really over the last 5 years in the number of students that want to get into the forestry. You know, there's a lot of interest in the environment. And you know, we have, you know, several hundred environmental science majors and environmental studies majors. Those are fairly broad, you know, disciplines. You're really not going to leave that major with, you know, a tremendous tool set that can address a unique problem in a single ecosystem. But if you go into forestry, you know, and you really care about forests, you really are developing, you know, the skills and knowledge that allows you to be an effective environmental scientist within the best, I think, ecosystem there is in the globe. And so a lot of students have become more and more interested in developing solutions to these really brutal challenges that our forests are facing. And so, you know, the best way to develop those solutions and be part of that change is to become a forester. And so we really are seeing a lot of interest in the major and really, you know, a real diversity of the identities and individuals that are being attracted to that. And so it's, you know, even though there's definitely still a lot of screen time and other things happening with our generation, you know, when they recreate, when they enjoy, you know, going outside or going for a drive, you know, forests are part of that. And so being able to get a job where, you know, your office is primarily outside, occasionally you are doing some things inside, but it's pretty attractive to any generation, including the current one.
Michael Snyder, how does your Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation work with UVM's forestry program?
I'm glad you asked that. It's worth pointing out that I am a proud alum of the UVM forestry program myself.
Congratulations.
Thank you, yes. And I have to say, it was before Tony's time, but it's really, really lucky to have Tony and his colleagues there providing this. It was a profoundly important time in my life. I consider myself to be one of the luckiest people, and a big part of that was finding my way into UVM forestry and what it's done for me and launched just a wonderful life in the woods and related. And it's true for several of our staff. I had classmates of mine at UVM are among our staff, long veterans serving, and we continue to do that. So it starts there, and then we have, which we like to include wherever we can, with getting kids involved. Students, Tony mentioned the sort of outdoor classroom approach. We partner with them, with our land base, some of our staff helping with that. So we try to engage. We try to create internship opportunities, seasonal employment opportunities for forestry students. It's very important. And, of course, partnering, as Tony said, on the science and the helping us, you know, kind of arm us with that technical assistance, the basis for that technical assistance that we try to communicate and disseminate to landowners, to forest professionals, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So in many different ways that we engage, and it's a really important relationship. It's very healthy and productive and powerful.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Bill joining us from Dummerston. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. So I have a question. The emerald ash borer, I know, is apparently already you know, shown up in the state. And I look around my very small patch of land, and I have some really, really beautiful, big, different size ash trees. And I've also seen a local logger advertising to come in and, you know, take them out. So they're just the most wonderful trees for so many reasons, as any forester would know. So my question is, you know, is it just inevitable that they're gonna pass away? Do I do anything? Do I wait? A lot of questions about them, and so sorry to see them go if that's their fate.
Bill, I'm really glad you asked that question. We might also expand that to hemlocks and the hemlock woolly adelgid. Who wants to take this? You know, what is, should you be proactive? What is the right thing to do? What are you recommending to people, Tony or Michael?
Well, I'll take a quick stab here, and then turn it to Tony for the real goods, and demonstrate just how lucky we are to have him. He's the silviculturalist here, and right. But I just can't resist. I want to start with appreciate the sentiment. It was Bill, I think, and thank you for your awareness and your concern. You're right; they're amazing trees. I'd start with this: don't be rash with your ash. There's no reason to be. It is a serious threat. This insect kills ash trees, but our guidance generally is: don't be rash. We have assistance, so you know this. You call your county forester, get an assessment. And really, it comes down to making some choices. Our general guidance is, sure, if you've been investing in managing your woods and want to capture some economic return, kind of pre-salvaging before they would be killed and making use of those ash trees in some productive way and an economic return, that's totally legitimate. We would just ask that you maybe not rush into it and take all of them. Keep some ash in various size categories on the forest. We're trying to buy time for biological control, for other management techniques, and maybe to benefit from heritable resistance, a genetic level of resistance in these trees. And it's quite early, and we need to buy some time. And so we have some written guidance. We can give you extra guidance on how to apply that in your woods. And with that, how'd I do, Tony? That was a self-quiz.
No, you did fantastic, Mike. And again, I just, you know, the job that Forest Parks and Recreation does in terms of landowner guidance. You know, I've been working with Emerald Ash Borer in various parts of the country. And, you know, when I first read the guidance that the state of Vermont produced for this, it was the most thoughtful and really ecologically balanced, guidance on us. Because as Mike pointed out, when we have these threats to different tree species, the first response often is a rash one. You know, that tree is threatened. I'm going to go cut it out of the forest. And sometimes what we find out is actually the impacts of that irrational response is greater than the impact of the insect itself. And so really thinking through, you know, you value those trees, sounds like largely because you like to admire them and enjoy just the aesthetic value. And so if you're not, you know, foregoing major economic, impacts by letting those trees exist in your landscape, maybe as Mike mentioned, there could be some natural resistance to emerald ash borer. But if there isn't, you know, and those trees aren't a hazard to your home or a trail, you know, you'll ultimately have some really nice big dead trees out there, which we know also provide a lot of ecological value. And so, as Mike really well put, you know, if you are going to cut those trees, do it in a thoughtful way that really is thinking about future options on the site and thinking about that forest ecosystem as opposed to just managing in response to forest insects. So really, I would have stolen Mike's great catch line. I answered that first, which is don't be rash about your ash. It summarizes it perfectly.
I agree. Bill, great question. And I think this could be the next Eat More Kale t-shirt for Vermont. Don't be rash with your ash. Can't wait for those t-shirts to come back. Got a great email from Steve in Waterbury Center. And he writes, the conversation about the benefits of a forested landscape remind me of something Michael once said that resounded with me. We tend to think of forest as a noun, but Michael encouraged us to think of it as a verb, to forest. The forest is not simply a place. It is a working, functioning place. What a great quote. What a great email. Michael, you sound like a genius. I do want to take off on that, though. And, Tony, how do you work with landowners to make sure that they are using best forest management practices?
Well, as you know, Mike mentioned, I certainly wouldn't take credit for a lot of what happens through both our county foresters and then as well as, you know, extension and all the great consulting foresters that we have in the state. But, you know, when we talk about, you know, land use change and certainly insects and diseases and so forth, and then look at our forested landscape, as you pointed out, you know, it really are these landowners, you know, almost 80,000 individuals own kind of the forest land that makes up a large proportion of Vermont's landscape. And so it really is, how do you communicate and connect with the diversity of individuals and get them to understand your forest? And then that includes the value that those forests provide from a, you know, carbon or water cycling or just a aesthetic amenity value. And so, you know, we definitely do a lot of research, but we also care a lot about both doing engagement through landowner outreach pamphlets. I've been fortunate over the years to partner with Paul Catanzaro at the University of Massachusetts Extension and developing these tools that are a bit more approachable by a wide audience. I'm not just someone with the brain power that Mike has. And so they're really trying to get folks to connect to forest, because somebody might own forest land and really not have, you know, a deep interest in forestry or forest ecology that Mike has or you have or I have. And so really trying to make sure that we're connecting with them. And so that includes doing nowadays a lot of webinars, so web-based events. I'll actually be doing one with the Huntington Conservation Commission in mid-April, so kind of talking to kind of a wide audience about, you know, different ways to build value forests, manage forests, and do that appropriately. But taking advantage of various forms of communication to do that, and really to get people to really recognize that there's this resource out there that we do take for granted many times in the state. And so, you know, connecting those landowners to the values that their land provides and the ways in which they can be effective stewards over time is really critical.
Michael, what is your message to Vermonters who want to make sure that our trees and our forests survive and thrive?
You know, really, Tony's hitting on it really well. I really have a strong sense that's built from a life working in the woods with people, that it's connecting. It's time in the woods, time it with a tree. You did a great job, Rick, when you mentioned the diamond in the woods and the in your childhood. That's true for so many, and we tend to lose that and forget it. So engaging with the woods, just being with trees is the first step, because I believe very strongly your experience that leads to many good things. People just become more engaged. They care, they learn, then they act. It influences the way they interact with the woods. It affects the way they make purchases, the way they raise their kids, the way they vote. I think that's really the start, is engagement. And take advantage of this incredible network of professional expertise and communicators that we have in this state about forests. And so a good gateway in is with our county foresters who work for the department and are there to support private landowners and schools, et cetera, nonprofits. And so through them is a great gateway to other professionals, that then just building on engagement. And I think that's the starting point. And really, you mentioned, you know, the sap's running. Before you know it, spring will be here and the forests will break their winter dormancy. And this, once again, I think it's a time, like in the fall with the glorious display of color, the spring reemergence of green is another great time to just stop and pause and realize just how darn lucky we are, how much it's beautiful, and then it's so much more behind that, what we get from it, and then think further, why do we have this? This is because of generations of family owners, those 80,000 owners, and a history of people engaging and interacting with the land intelligently, closely, locally, and more built on good, solid ecological information from the likes of Tony D'Amato.
Well, Tony D'Amato, you know, the pandemic has gotten Vermonters to really get out there, get fresh air, get into the forests. But as we do that, is there certain forest etiquette we should be observing?
Yeah, I think, you know, the real positive, if there are, you know, any that we can draw from in terms of the pandemic, as from our walk of life, has been that more people are recognizing forests are great. And as you pointed out with your intro and Mike just reiterated, you know, people are making this connection that this is a place that maybe I didn't spend a lot of time in, and now that I have this connection to, I might care more about and certainly get involved with. nevertheless, you know, we have a lot of people, you know, within quick striking distance of our forests through some major cities and even here, you know, in Vermont. And so there can be the tendency to kind of crowd into areas and you know, many folks hiking along trails and so forth. And so I think, you know, from an etiquette perspective, you know, much of it is, you know, obviously not littering, not, you know, going off those trails and bushwhacking your own trails and having impact, you know, beyond which, you know, that, that recreation infrastructure was already, you know, built to sustain. And also, you know, some of the etiquette of even, you know, those that camp a lot and move throughout, you know, a lot of our invasive insects are spread by people moving firewood around. And so, you know, really being responsible about even, you know, camping and kind of where you get your wood from. Obviously, local wood is the best in general for many reasons, but especially when it comes to kind of minimizing the spread of insects and diseases and so forth. And so I think, you know, I don't want to say we don't want crowds going to the woods. Obviously, it changes the environment for some, but we also want to make sure the woods are accessible to a whole range of individuals. And so I think the key is just making sure those individuals have an ethic, you know, that, you know, we're not leaving trash, you know, or we're using designated facilities and are allowed to do that again for various things. And so making sure that, you know, that impact on this amazing recreation infrastructure that Vermont has, again, thanks to both incredible efforts by the federal government and state government to create them, are preserved and maintained despite this increased interest.
Adding to my line of invasive insect T-shirts, one that will read, as Michael said, don't be rash with your ash. I'm going to also have, let's get rid of the hemlock woolly adelgid. All right, gentlemen?
Sounds good.
All right. We had Michael Snyder, Vermont's Forest, Parks, and Recreation Commissioner. Michael, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Pleasure. Thank you, Rick.
And Tony D'Amato, UVM, he's the head of UVM's Forest Program, the director there. And Tony, thank you. I really enjoyed having you on today.
Happy to do it. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Take care, both of you. We're going to break now for CBS News, and then we'll be back to talk to national correspondent Bob Ney. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and it's time to turn to national correspondent Bob Ney to get an idea of what happened this week. While we were all racing around in our workaday worlds, Bob is always taking notice of what's happening. So thanks, Bob, for being here.
Well, thank you, Rick. And, of course, that's my workaday world, taking notice.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love it. Let's start with how the COVID count is going.
Right. The total deaths are 2,628,000 worldwide. The total deaths in America are 530,000. So, you know, every week, I'm always glad you bring it up because it, you know, for all this time gives us a handle on where we're going, where we're at. And in fact, we no longer include in the stats, the U.S. recoveries, because U.S. recoveries are great. Our testing has been 367,000. And then you have, confirmed cases. As of today, it was 29 million. So the amount of deaths is obviously, you know, decreasing statistically, and the tests are up, and of course the vaccinations are on the rise.
They are, as a matter of fact. I hope the next good news is what we heard from President Biden, and he wants to have all adults who are eligible for vaccines to have a vaccine by May 1st.
Right, and, you know, there had been, by the time President Trump left, although, you know, it's been question of how, obviously, the president handled the whole situation, the statements he made, et cetera, but the vaccines were beginning, and there were a lot of vaccines that were, you know, given. I think that the Trump administration put the expectations high and then didn't achieve what they wanted. The Biden administration kind of knew they'd hit the, you know, million vaccine mark because they were at, I think, 980,000 by the time he became president. So they're, I think, not downplaying it or making it down low. I think what they're doing is making it, you know, more acceptable and more able to target what they're saying they want to.
Yeah. And the good news about, I guess, vaccines, too, in the U.S., we lead the world right now, don't we, in most vaccines administered?
Yes, you know, there's a very bright side to this story. The United States has 4% of the world's population, 20% of all recorded COVID-19 deaths, and nearly 30% of all the vaccine doses available in the world have been done here. We usually statistically kind of run like that, 5% of the world's population, and we use 50% of the energy. You know, the United States tends to be big in what it does. But in the vaccines, we're leading the entire world. United States, United Kingdom have sprinted far ahead of everybody else under the sun. Surprisingly, Canada and the European Union have struggled to get it done. Now, the sad note on this is the African countries, in many, many cases, have yet to do one single dose, not one.
Yeah, that's sad. That is absolutely something we don't want. And we realize how all tied globally we are, especially with this pandemic. And so it doesn't help us to have countries who don't receive any vaccines at all. One thing that is different from the Biden to the, you know, from the Trump administration is his relationship and embracing of Dr. Fauci and his message.
Yes, you know, if you listen to, you know, the extreme right, it was, you know, a horrifically terrible speech. If you listen to the extreme left, it was one of the best things that's been down the path, you know, which is par for course, don't get me wrong. But with the talk that Biden had, President Biden, you know, talked about the vaccination. He talked, obviously, a lot about COVID. Now we will hear him talk a lot about the stimulus bill. This is a smart political approach. He's talking basically kind of, you know, highlighting what he's done here because President Obama really made a mistake, and Biden at the time had advised him not to do this. He did the stimulus plan, and within one day he's talking about everything else. So President Biden focused, you know, on this. The one part of the message which, though, I think personally could have been downplayed or actually not even included in last night's speech was when he said, listen to Dr. Fauci. And the reason I say that is that, you know, as the president says, we want, you know, by July the 4th to have the family barbecues, et cetera. If you look at some of the things Dr. Fauci says, which is wear two masks and, you know, even if you've had the vaccinations, be careful hugging your grandkids. And so I'm not trying to berate Dr. Fauci, you know, period, as, you know, as a complete problem, but I just kind of thought, you know, don't make Dr. Fauci the focal point. I thought that's one of the things that President Biden last night could have said. We're going to continue to listen to medical experts, and then the president can give the guidance, you know.
Absolutely. Well, how does this this new bill, the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, how does that contrast with Obama's stimulus bill from 2009?
Well, it's very interesting to hear Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader of the Senate, and other top Democrats say that Obama's bill was, quote, measly. That's what I think Schumer it was, or one of the other Democrat members had called it, measly. Well, for the time, you know, it might have been, you know, a big bill. I've never thought we'd be into trillion-dollar bills. Right. President Obama's bill was about $890, you know, billion. People felt he should have done more. So this bill, they're kind of highlighting it by saying that his bill was lower, which is an okay tactic, but different bills, different years, different issues, really. I mean, I think it's unfair to look at the Obama administration's bill, and this bill is, quote, the same. They had different objectives as stimulus packages. Time will tell, of course, how this bill comes out, and obviously, I don't think many people object to the $1,400 payments. there were some other things added into the bill, which, you know, the Republicans are objecting to. The Republicans, in a sense, politically, I guess, Rick, can have their cake and eat it too, maybe, mm-hmm. by saying, look, I would have supported $1,400 a person, but look what happened in the last year to the business component of this. Look what happened, in the last year to the other parts of this bill. But substance-wise, they went big. We went big on two other bills when Trump was president.
That's right. One right before he left office. Yes. So now one of the big issues that President Biden has to face is what's going on the border.
This one is something that I've been watching literally since the day after President Biden took office. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having served in Congress, Rick, and, you know, I remember when President Bush brought us a bill, we had a Republican-controlled House, and I remember in a closed-door meeting, people were ready to, you know, run over to the White House and, you know, scream at him. They were calling it asylum, et cetera, because Bush was really trying to do something with it, as Reagan, you know, did, frankly, at one point in time, talking about Republicans. But on this one, this issue is in, at least if you look at exactly what's happening, the Republicans are headed to the border Monday and the Democrats are headed to the border Monday. Going to be two big outcomes that are going to be different on that. Both of them, however, are going to be a headache for the Biden administration, because on the Democratic side, they're going to say, look, we're lacking 22,000 beds. We're lacking space. These kids don't have a place to go. And on the Republican side, of course, they're going to say, who caused this? Mm-hmm. You know, this is what's going on. But I think that the stimulus plan and the vaccinations are the number one and two priorities of the Biden administration, frankly, and should be. But this one, Rick, it's not becoming a crisis in the next 5 or 6 months. It's beginning its stage very quickly because they're out of beds, 22,000 beds. There are people in other, countries that are saying, here, we'll take your kids for you. It's opening back up, and there may be a run to the border, and that's going to be a headache. So I would assume the president's going to have to keep an eye on that.
Absolutely. And let's take one more look. We'll go to the House and some bills on gun background checks.
Right. It was a vote of 227 to 203. There were a few Republicans that voted for it, but, not too many. And what the House said was that they wanted to close the Charleston loophole, and that's when Dylann Roof bought a firearm and he used it to kill 9 people in a black church in 2015. And how that happened is it went a certain period of time, and he was able to purchase that gun, even though he had a criminal conviction, because of a clerical error, and that caused the FBI's background check to take longer than 3 days. So this would provide for more of, probably a more expansive ability to look at this and to try to get around any type of clerical error. And, of course, the Republicans have said this is a form of gun control and it was unneeded. Doesn't probably face a very bright prospect in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. All right. National correspondent Bob Ney, as always, thanks so much for your
take on what
happened this week. Great talking to
you.
All right.
You too.
When Moreau Weinberger won his first bid to be mayor of Burlington, he defeated Republican Kurt Wright rather handily. There was no progressive in the race after 3 terms for Bob Kiss. A 7 Days headline read, "Whither the Progs?" Last week, Moreau won again, but it was a far different story than his previous 3 general election wins. Here to discuss this race is 7 Days News reporter Courtney Lambden. Courtney, thanks for being on with us this morning.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Courtney, how surprising was the close finish between Moreau Weinberger and Council President Max Tracy?
You know, the answer to that probably depends on who you ask. But I think that, for progressives, they would probably say they're not too surprised because, after 9 years of the same administration, I think they would argue that some people are looking for change. Moreau also had a really tough last term. Mm-hmm. It was kind of plagued with various scandals and challenges. And, I think that the progressives saw that as an opportunity to potentially win this race. But I don't know if anyone expected it to be this close by 129 votes.
Yeah, after three terms, and even governors who here serve two-year terms, Mayor of Burlington, we should note, serves a three-year term. So after three terms in the mayor's office, you do start to have different factions angry at one time or another. So isn't this kind of expected, that you lose a little altitude and you lose a little bit of the luster that you have as the mayor of Burlington?
Yeah, you know, I think, like you said, anyone who's been in office for a good amount of time, I think, has to work harder to get the base excited to come out and vote. Even if they generally like the way things are going, you have to work harder to kind of counter the other side's energy that they have to kind of push you out. So I think that, I think Weinberger probably saw that in the results.
So how are the progressives looking at this? Where do they see, where they might be able to capitalize on it?
Yeah, so the progressives are looking at this, the voting results, and the results of several ballot items that were voted on in Burlington this town meeting day as kind of a mandate for them to continue pushing for the agenda that they have been the last couple years. The ballot items included things to bring back ranked choice voting, which Weinberger has been opposed to ban no-cause evictions. Weinberger didn't take a public position on that one, but he also, in doing so, he wasn't the face of it in any way. Mm-hmm. Rather, the progressives had that opportunity to really push for these items to pass. They're looking at this, and those all passed overwhelmingly. All of the ballot items passed with more than 60% support. Wow. The progressives are saying this gives us a mandate to continue pushing our aggressive agenda, and we'll see what that looks like. There's no real proposals on the table quite yet.
So right afterwards, Mayor Weinberger was contrite, and I'm wondering, does that really mean he's going to shift a little left to meet the progs, or is that just a statement you make after a very close race?
Yeah, he definitely said he was humbled. On election night, he said he was humbled by the closeness of the margin. It was less than one percentage point. But at the same time, he has pledged to collaborate more and talk with the progressives and try and find common ground on a lot of these issues that have really divided Burlington. But at the same time, he didn't really pledge to move on any of those issues, like soften his stance on any of these policies that the progressives have really been pushing him. A big one, obviously, in Burlington has been police reform. And, it's really unclear how the city is going to move forward with oversight proposals. At the end of last year, the progressives had proposed creating an oversight board called a community control board, which would have given citizens, the power to investigate and even terminate off. The mayor vetoed that. And so now they're kind of back to square one and trying to figure out where do we move forward with this. And I think that's really going to be a real test to show, just how Weinberger can move forward with this really energized progressive caucus.
Let's go back to Moreau's first mayoral race. When we were all trying to figure out how to pronounce his first name, the Democratic caucus had a very strong field, and the third ballot ended in a tie. I remember the Dems were calling people back to Memorial Auditorium. They had to schedule another day to vote again. Do you remember this, to pick their candidate?
Yes, I wasn't reporting on Burlington, but I was living near Burlington, so I definitely remember reading about it, and I've since read about it now that I'm reporting on the city.
Right. So he did have a close race, but it was in the Democratic caucus. But let's go back in history a little longer. The last time there was a close mayoral race this close in Burlington was
Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
And so in 1981, a young and rising Bernie Sanders, he knocked off the incumbent, who was a Democrat, by just 10 votes. So the city, I asked them, is this really the closest race? It's definitely the closest one in recent memory. So, that was the smallest of margins. And, you know, a lot of people, a lot of the progressives today look to Bernie Sanders as kind of the leader of the movement that they want to carry forward. So it's an interesting dynamic for sure.
It is. I mentioned the headline that 7 Days ran back, you know, 9 years ago when Moreau won for the first time, and it read, "Wither the Progs." So how have they risen back up from what was, you know, a really difficult time after, I think it was two terms, with Bob Kiss as the mayor?
Yeah, so that is true. I remember that headline as well. It's really changed for the progressives, particularly since the 2019 city council elections. Mm-hmm. So at that time, we saw the city council president, Jane Nodell. She's been a stalwart of the Progressive Party in Burlington. She lost her own party's nomination to one of the kind of new wave, new progs, Perry Freeman. Mm-hmm. And Jane ran as an independent and lost to Perry on town meeting day that year. That same election, Jack Hansen, another new prog, booted an incumbent Democrat off of the council. And really since then, the progressives have really kind of upped their organizing ground game. And last year on town meeting day, we saw another young progressive knock off a, you know, Democrat in Ward 8. That would be Jane Stromberg taking Adam Roof's spot. And the biggest news out of that election was when Uriah Hightower beat 32-year incumbent Sharon Busher. Mm. So Sharon Busher kind of leaned progressive, but Uriah was really kind of all in. She took on the party label, and this, now there are 6 progressives on the council, which is the most that there have been in Weinberger's entire tenure. So they don't have a voting majority. They need one more person always to pass a vote on the 12-member council. They need 7 votes, but it's really made them a force to be reckoned with on the council.
So, Courtney, does this indicate that Burlington has moved even further left?
Yeah, I think that definitely progressives would say yes. I think that they are in a position to really push for these aggressive policies. It didn't go very far last year, but Councillor Perry Freeman, who I mentioned before, they introduced this very far left slate of proposed charter changes that would, you know, set a minimum wage for Burlington workers. The Just Cause eviction ballot item that passed this year actually stemmed from this kind of vision that Perry put out there. The council didn't end up voting on it. They decided that it needed more time to be vetted, but that really gives a preview of what the progressives want to do in Burlington. And I think they're going to look at this past election and the overwhelming passage of these other ballot items to say, this is what Burlington wants. And in truth, the Democrats supported a lot of these. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, the progressives can't pass any of these on their own. And for this Just Cause eviction, there was another kind of energy climate change related initiative. All of them are really bipartisan. So, you know, I think that even the Democrats and the progressives, they can agree on some things. And this last year, we saw what that can do on a ballot. These really, you know, progressive, broad-based changes that they want to bring.
In 2021 in Burlington, should the headline be "Wither the GOP"?
Perhaps. Yeah. I think, you know, since, Republican Kurt Wright, he was the city council president. He decided not to run for reelection, as he now hosts a radio show on WVMT. And so he was really the last Republican on the council. And they have not caucused. They haven't put up any candidates, as far as I know, even for positions such as elections inspector or, you know, the smaller type positions on the ballot. But yeah, I think that could be a good question. I mean, we saw the Colby LaMarche, I think he's the chair of the Burlington Republicans, saying, you know, he kind of made a statement that he felt that the state GOP was too aligned with Trump. And, you know, in Burlington, that doesn't really fly, even with the GOP. So it's kind of interesting. I think that there is still a conservative, you know, part of Burlington, but not an elected office anymore.
Courtney, we have about a minute left, and I wonder if, like the statewide, where we have, you know, the House and Senate dominated by Democrats, yet we have a Republican governor. Burlington, maybe the same thing, where voters want to have a more moderate mayor to keep things in check?
It definitely could be that. I think that Moreau, I think he benefited this election by presenting his platform of proven leadership. He has been a really good financial steward of the city. He helped bring the city out of the Burlington Telecom kind of fiasco. And he has used that in every campaign. And I think that now that the city's coming out of the pandemic, that really appealed to a lot of people. So I think that potentially people saw their options on the ballot and went for Moreau as someone who to provide stability. And, you know, those are still really important to the electorate in Burlington.
Any sense of this is if this is his last mayoral campaign?
You know, I don't know. A lot of people have kind of just mentioned offhand that they, you know, think that Moreau, you know, they're not really sure what his aim is. Like, there's a lot of speculation about, you know, what is he going to do. If, you know, when he finishes this term, I'm pretty sure he will be the longest serving mayor. You know, there are mayors, Peter Glavelle served for more years combined, but Moreau would have had the longest continuous tenure.
Right.
So I don't know. That could be a nice note to go out on. We'll have to see.
All right. Courtney Lambden is a news reporter for 7 days. Hey, Courtney, thank you so much for this.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
Good. Really enjoyed having you. And you can find Courtney's story in this week's 7 days or at 7daysvt.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Mammoths are next.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Sunday morning, there it was, on the front page of the Boston Globe, breaking mammoth news. And when I say mammoth news, I don't mean like a big story. I mean big news about a woolly mammoth. The discovery was made by someone from Dartmouth College, and he and it have a connection to Vermont. Yes. With lightning speed, I was firing off an email to Amy Olson, who does excellent work in the college, Dartmouth College's communication office. And thus we now have Nathaniel Kitchell with us. He's a postdoctoral fellow in anthropology at Dartmouth. Nathaniel, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate being here. I am so glad to have you. Listeners, if you've got mammoth questions, I mean questions about mammoths, for Nathaniel, give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Nathaniel, I never thought I'd be doing an interview about mammoth news, and so this really does get me excited. First of all, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Well, I was going to say, honestly, I didn't think I'd be doing this either.
I know. Wait till people hear the story. This is so great. And before we start mucking around in the archives, or before you did, what was the commonly held belief about man and mammoth in New England?
So amongst the archaeological community and the paleontological community, it seemed that the material evidence from radiocarbon dates that the first humans in the region and mammoths were actually pretty far apart in time, as in the first mammoths appear to have gone extinct maybe sometime around 13,500 years ago, and the first humans that we have evidence for seem to have arrived sometime around 12,800, 12,700 years ago. I will add to that that the indigenous peoples in Vermont, the Abenaki, do have stories of potentially talking about mammoths, oral histories, and the like. So it's not necessarily surprising that this result that this result brought them a little bit closer together. But up until that point, we didn't have material evidence indicating that that was the case.
So we were all under the premise that we just missed the mammoths here by about 700 or 800 years. And what was the was it the same in other parts of North America or other parts of the world?
No, it was absolutely not. Certainly in other parts of North America, there's strong archaeological evidence that humans and mammoths and mastodons were interacting. Humans may even have been hunting these animals around 13,000 years ago, and we have particularly strong evidence of that in parts of the western United States, in like Wyoming and Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, for example. But the further east you go, the thinner that material evidence gets. And when you get here into the Northeast, particularly northern New England, one, we have very limited evidence of mammoths at all, no material evidence to indicate that humans and mammoths or mastodons were interacting. So no human-made artifacts associated with the bones of a woolly mammoth or a mastodon.
So other than what the evidence suggested, was there some kind of theory as to why, in the Northeast we didn't have mammoths as long as they did elsewhere, or why humans didn't show up in time for mammoths? What was the thinking?
So a major question in North American archaeology and paleontology is just what happened to these animals. And so what you have happening at the end of the last ice age is the first widespread appearance of humans throughout North America, almost instantaneously. And subsequently, the disappearance, the extinction of mammoths and mastodons. But you also have a really powerful period of climate change, as you might imagine, mm-hmm. at the end of the last ice age. And so it's really unclear what was happening to mammoths at that point, and whether they were, gradually going extinct simply because the climate was changing around them. And in the Northeast, it may simply have been that climate changed in ever so slightly a different way that simply caused them to go extinct before the first people may have showed up.
So, Nathaniel, I hope you don't mind, but I want to bring you back to kind of the near present. I want to know what you were doing at the Hood Museum of Art, and what did you happen upon?
So I was invited by folks at the Hood to just go give a quick inspection to a small collection of Native American artifacts that are housed at the Hood that have been donated to the museum over time by various benefactors from various places around, mostly Vermont and New Hampshire. And just to try to make a little bit more sense of it, evaluate research potential, just sort of see what my eye saw mm-hmm. when I looked at those stone tools. And as a part of that, I was walking through the movable shelving, the big, tall, repository cases, mostly packed with objects of art and other cultural artifacts. And very close to the collections of stone tools was this relatively large bone. It had the appearance of being old. Fossils don't look like young bone. They're not white at all. They're often stained brown, sometimes very darkly brown. Mm-hmm. And I noticed this, and it immediately piqued my curiosity. So I just had to reach down and look at the tag and see what it was. And on a little paper tag affixed to that bone said, Mount Holly Mammoth, railroad cut, 1848, Mount Holly, Vermont. And I was fairly shocked because not 2 weeks before, I had spoken to folks at the Mount Holly Community Historical Museum about my archaeological research. Like, I don't tend to study mammoths, as the case may be. Mm-hmm. And so the alignment of those two events pretty surprising to me, and obviously I was excited about what I just found, because in doing research for my talk to Mount Holly, I knew that there was no radiocarbon date for not just the Mount Holly mammoth, but for any elephant remains in the state of Vermont.
Now, the talk you gave, isn't the Vermont State Fossil the Mount Holly mammoth, or am I making that up, or...
That's correct. The Mount Holly Mammoth is the Vermont State Terrestrial Fossil.
A terrestrial fossil, okay.
That's right. The specificity there comes because the Vermont State Marine Fossil is Charlotte the Whale.
Oh, right. Okay, gotcha. All right, that makes a lot of sense. But how did this particular bone wind up at the Hood Museum of Art?
That is something of a mystery that I'm not sure I fully understand the intricacies of just yet. So the object was recorded to have been donated by a fellow by the name of William A. Bacon, who was a resident of Ludlow, which is just down the road from Mount Holly.
Mm-hmm.
And my research found that he was a publisher in town by at least 1853-ish, so just before the discovery. And I've recently been presented with some materials that indicate that he may have actually been a surveyor for the railroad in 1848 when it went through the summit of the Green Mountains at Mount Holly. Regardless of how it may have happened, it appears that he somehow got a hold of a piece of this animal, which would not have been uncommon for the time, that folks around would try to gather up a piece of history for their own collection.
Right.
And then at some point between 1848 and, say, 1880, that piece, he apparently gifted that piece of the mammoth to Dartmouth College, but there were no records of that I was aware of prior to stumbling across that bone in the collections.
Wow. Okay, Nathaniel, you find this bone. What were your first thoughts about this mammoth bone?
I was pretty shocked to see it. Like I said, there was no record that I'd come across that indicated that there should be a piece of it at Dartmouth College. And given that the specimen had never, or the mammoth had never been radiocarbon dated, so we didn't really know how old it is. It's a wide range, sometime after the glacier melted and sometime probably before, I don't know, say 10,000 years ago, was that range that the age of this creature could have been. So, you know, my first thought was we should try to radiocarbon date it and see what we get. Just to learn a little bit more about the animal, about the history of the state, and just see what happens.
Well, that was a brilliant idea. What did you find?
So from the radiocarbon date, we found that this animal was probably alive or probably died sometime around 12,800 years ago. And this is exciting for a number of different reasons. One, it's the most recent mammoth or mastodon, one of the most recent radiocarbon dates for either of those creatures that we have found, that scientists have found anywhere in New England, which is pretty cool.
Right.
And two, that brings in New England and the Northeast more broadly, that brings the earliest radiocarbon dates we have for the first human occupations of the region quite a bit closer together with radiocarbon dates for some of the last mammoths. So that's also a pretty exciting finding. And the implication being that it may have been that the first human groups in the Northeast shared the landscape with some of the last mammoths.
So as I mentioned earlier, cool. We thought before that man missed mammoth here in New England by about 700 to 800 years. So where does this bring man and mammoth in New England?
Almost right on top of each other.
Wow.
At least in time.
Uh-huh.
So notwithstanding the sort of idiosyncrasies of radiocarbon dating, it's not a perfect analysis. It's not a perfect process, right? There's error, a statistical error associated with these dates. You can't be 100% certain that these dates overlap, but just bringing it that much closer was a pretty big find in my mind. And that was quite cool for me.
It would have been helpful if early man had a cell phone and could have taken a picture and we would have known for sure. But the technology would have been different anyway. But why is this a big deal if humans, and I am joking, but I am serious about how important, how exciting this really is. Why is it a big deal if humans and mammoths did or didn't overlap in this region?
From the scientific standpoint, from the paleontological and archaeological standpoint, a lot of researchers are trying to understand ultimately what happened to these animals, why they may have gone extinct, and is this attributable to hunting pressure by people, climate change, or maybe even a more agnostic approach, a combination of a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that broader discussion, and this is a global phenomenon, right? There are no more woolly mammoths with mastodon anywhere on the planet, as well as a number of different species of megafauna. So understanding what happened to those creatures is really important, if not just for broader interest, but potentially conservation efforts today as well. So this is a pretty big question that we just zoom in on in Vermont, because prior to that, it appeared that climate change was almost certainly the culprit. And it's now slightly more possible that humans could have been involved in some capacity, but this doesn't necessarily say that that is or is not the case.
Right. Interesting. Now, give us some idea of, let's talk about the mammoth, the size of the mammoths, maybe in relation to current day elephants.
They can actually be quite a bit bigger.
Wow.
Larger again than an African elephant. And a lot of the elephants you'll see in zoos are Asian elephants, which are smaller. So this is an animal that was, again, quite a bit larger than the elephants most of us would have seen in zoos. And even if you've had been fortunate enough to go on an African safari, bigger yet than those animals. So just absolutely enormous creatures. They could have weighed up to 20,000 pounds.
Hmm. Now, is there anything alive today, maybe a whale or something, that could rival them in size?
Certainly some whales, but of course it would be even larger. The blue whale is one of the largest creatures that's ever lived. But it's just such a different animal to have it walking around on the landscape. And indeed, some of the indigenous oral histories might speak of them perhaps as moving mountains to give you an idea of just how big these animals were, right? Just absolutely enormous. Contemporary elephants are large enough. If you go to a zoo and you think like I do, it's like, I can't wrap my head around the idea of going up and like poking it with a stick to try to eat it.
Boy, if you invited a mammoth over for dinner, you knew when they were on their way up the front path there. Why? What would we have been killing them for? Meat, fur, tools? What would the early man have killed mammoths for?
All of those have been hypothesized. Certainly food to eat, and there are relatively recent historic records of people around the world killing and eating elephants. So meat for sure, but also, yeah, absolutely an important source of materials to make tools, right? Like ivory is an incredibly useful material. And there is some evidence from around the world that people in the deep past were actually harvesting the ivory from the tusks of these animals to produce various tools. Now, unfortunately, in the archaeological record, a lot of that stuff made from bone and ivory, those tools simply don't preserve, especially here in New England. So we don't have any record of that here. But in other places, yes. So all sorts of stuff, a very useful suite of materials from these really large animals.
How was your rib bone there able to preserve?
So from a fairly unusual circumstance, as some folks might know, the soils in Vermont are, tend to be relatively thin in many of the upland areas, thin and rocky, and also very biologically active and acidic. So bone breaks down really quickly if it's just buried in regular old dirt, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But the bone and the Mount Holly remains themselves were actually preserved at the bottom of a bog. They were recorded to have been found over 12 feet down in a bog that was once a pond. And so that environment's special because it lacks oxygen. And because of that, it was very calm and lacking oxygen. So there were no microorganisms chewing up this bone. And for that reason, it was preserved over 12,000 years.
Wow. So where does this research go next, Nathaniel?
Well, a couple of different directions, I think. The first most basic one is we want to check our work. As I said, radiocarbon dating isn't a perfect process. There's a number of problems that can arise that can skew your date either older or younger. And so it's important to send another sample out to a different lab to make sure that those results are consistent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any reason to think that they wouldn't be, but it's important to be able to say that. We have my colleagues and I from Dartmouth have also recently gone up with ground penetrating radar to the bog where this animal may have been found to actually look through those sediments with this radar instrument to see if there might be anything else down there that the railroad construction missed. And then also try to sort of locate any other specimens of elephants and other really old animals, Ice Age animals, that may have been found in Vermont. There is another tusk, at least one other tusk that has been recovered, as well as a couple of other examples of other creatures, including a caribou that might date to the Ice Age, and then also another extinct animal called a stag moose. It's actually more closely related to an elk. But those were also present here in New England, and some remains of those may have been found in Vermont as well. So a number of different directions. Cool stuff to learn more about the Ice Age of the state.
Very cool. We don't have a whole lot of time, but what is your specific area of study?
So my specific area of study is I'm actually an archaeologist. I study people in the past. But, of course, this is interesting to me because you can't understand the lives of people without understanding the animals that they shared the landscape with and the relationships that they may have had with those animals. Those are all very important because humans relied on these human-animal relationships for their survival, right? And so this intersects with my interest, and that's why my research tended to focus on the people as well as the mammoth. I'm a little bit out of my wheelhouse here, but I still think it was a really cool finding, and I'm excited to, you know, have helped, you know, learn a little bit more about Vermont. It's super cool for me, having grown up in the state.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Danville.
Yeah. Just right down Route 2 from us here.
That's
wow.
Right.
I got to say, this is really phenomenal. I know it's not your area of study, but now you will be linked with mammoths forever, and that is not a bad thing at all, is it?
No, I can't say that. I hate it. No, it's pretty cool.
Well done. Nathaniel Kitchell is a postdoctoral fellow at Dartmouth College, and keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on the show this morning. We really enjoyed it.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Keep those ideas, suggestions, topics, guests coming. We love them. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference will come up next after CBS News. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.